Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Joining me today from Ignacio, Colorado, and Holyoke, Massachusetts, it's Carlos Baca and Neftali, respectively, two chef educators from iCollective. The iCollective is a group of indigenous chefs, activists, herbalists, seed, and knowledge keepers. Indigenous communities have been wild foraging, cooking farm to table slash snout to tail, and manipulating closed loop agricultural systems before it got trendy. So why don't we see indigenous joints popping up everywhere? Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
So your manifesto champions four principles: indigenous, inspired, innovative, and independent. How did the iCollective get started?
There's a lot behind that story. The basics of it is that in recognizing that we didn't really, you know, there's only a handful of indigenous chefs that really get airtime. And we had to try to figure out what kind of platform we could build using those things that we have available to us as far as media and media support.
Yeah,
kind of create a platform for our younger generation of chefs and cooks and activists and whatnot to be visible.
Mm-hmm. You said only a few get airtime. Who are the people that get the airtime, and why only them?
That's a tricky question. I'd say of the people that actually get, regular media attention. Obviously, Sean Sherman from The Sous Chef. Say, like, Loretta Barrett Odin, Neftali and myself, Nephi Craig, Freddie Bitsui. You know, there's only a handful.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of getting, like, pigeonholed and letting people direct who gets attention, we're really trying to create this brand that holds all of those within it, right? So we're able to speak and move as a unit.
Hmm. And what are some challenges that are unique to the iCollective educators and chefs, let alone indigenous peoples in the food world?
Hi, it's Neftali here.
Oh,
thank you for having us. I think the just to follow up a little bit more on your last question,
mm-hmm.
Developing leadership from younger generations was and is one of the main priorities,
mm-hmm.
Especially leadership and from the young chefs that are in places where it's not they don't get a lot of visibility. So we have some. We have some younger chefs that are still living in reservations, and we really want to push for them to get a little bit more airtime. Challenges like anything else, trying to start an organization, have a collective voice presents challenges, especially taking into consideration for many generations we have been pinned against each other. Not only as indigenous peoples, but also as people of color.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up in a world where we taught not to trust each other, not to work with one another. So I think that's one of the greatest challenges.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think that maybe These younger chefs don't get airtime because they choose to kind of stay out of the limelight?
I would say personally, there are those that choose that. But a lot of these, if you're trying to gain support for work you're doing in your community, I think it's a valuable, asset to be able to reach outside of your box. And so that's what a lot of our younger chefs are using the iCollective for, is to gain traction and gain a voice for the work that they're doing in their own communities.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that kind of lack of visibility is unique to Indigenous chefs?
Yeah, we're definitely in the shadows of the food world, I would say. And so it's definitely going to be, you start seeing it a lot more now. Like, we're getting a lot more visibility.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's definitely, and for myself, I'm okay. I'm notoriously standoffish with media. And it's turned down things that most chefs reach for in goals that they try to do, in some of this content. And I do that because it's not about us. It's about this collective unity, mm-hmm. and this group and raising up our communities. So the media is not really important per se if the dialogue isn't correct. And mm-hmm. so... those are all things that we work with.
Yeah, I think that differs wildly from the kind of white culture, the white celebrity chef. I work at a restaurant, and this customer came in today, and she was telling me how it's hard to decipher between hype food and what's actually good food, because so many restaurants now kind of blow up their hype via social media, and you go and there's no story behind the food, or the food's not even that good. And so I think it's really kind of refreshing to hear chefs that are trying to, maybe sometimes choose to be in the spotlight and sometimes not.
Indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's Neftali here again. I think that definitely a lot, especially the younger chefs, are really media savvy. Really, really media savvy and very visible in our communities. Maybe the disconnection is that there's no media that aligns with the values, and maybe there's the media is slow to catch up with the values that a lot of these younger chefs and us are trying to talk about. So maybe there's a disconnect there, especially if we're talking about communities that have been historically disenfranchised and ignored for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's kind of like you're taking the nobler path or doing the bigger thing, because in this way you get to reconstruct or reappropriate the story and tell it in the way you would like it to be known.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We still haven't really gotten to the iCollective itself. What is kind of like a day in the life? So one of you is based in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and the other is in Ignacio, Colorado. Do you interact daily? What is it like?
there are so many people within the collective,
mm-hmm.
that, we have business threads, and we have iCollective threads, and we have individual threads for conversations regarding events that we have planned in different parts of the country. And so there's a constant flow of information and on the business end, and then there's the friendship end and the jokes and the playing around that we all do. And,
mm-hmm.
Definitely works towards a greater sense of community and understanding, because we do conversate daily.
Mm-hmm. What are some recent events that, or ones that you're working on now?
I'll drop the one that I'm working on currently, and then Neftali can run through some of the East Coast stuff. Right now, I'm working on, so my brand, I guess you would say, is the Taste of Native Cuisine, which I founded back in 2011, and I do pre-colonial pop-up dinners and educational work and things like that. Social justice, racial justice, food justice are all within that envelope, and I'm doing in partnership with Growing Partners of the Southwest and a few other groups, the Navajo Nation and Southern Ute, that we're doing a food justice symposium in late April to work in partnership with Somos Unidos and a bunch of different perspectives. So we have an indigenous perspective, immigrant perspective, white perspective, and African perspectives of where we are with food system in general and racism in the food system. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a 3-day event that myself will be speaking at. Rowan White from Sierra Seeds will be speaking at. And then we are working on an event with Tulalip up in outside of the reservation outside of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
To be doing a week-long series of events, working with their elders, doing some cooking within their communities, and also a pop-up in Seattle at London Pub. So on my end, that's where we are over here in Neftali.
Yeah, and Coral, thank you for asking that, because this actually this is right. This is something that is super important. We are sort of loosely calling the iCollective Year of Solidarity, mm-hmm. and we are hoping to do many events throughout the year in solidarity with other movements and in solidarity with the our indigenous brothers and sisters. And one event that is coming up. That is coming up right on your neck of the woods in New York City is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is observing a fast from March 11 to the 15, ending with a rally on the 15. And this fast is to bring attention to the struggle which has been going on for a few years, and to call for Wendy's, the fast food restaurant, to boycott Wendy's.
Mm.
And what the Coalition of Immokalee Workers are asking is something really simple that I think that all of your listeners can support. The Freedom Fast in New York City from March 11 to the 15 is to break the silence and to stop sexual abuse. Sexual violence in the fields. I'm just going to read something from their email today. For generations, farm worker women have endured sexual violence in the fields. But in 2011, farm worker women and men with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers launched the Fair Food Program in Florida. The program has finally put an end to sexual harassment and assault on tens of thousands of workers by harnessing the purchasing power of more than a dozen of the world's largest retail food companies, including a lot of the major food brands, all except Wendy's. Mm. So this is something that the collective is supporting, is trying to support not only in social media, but hopefully some of our members will be able to, at least one of our members will be able to join them in New York City.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to backtrack a little bit. You, Carlos, you mentioned that you host these dinners where you feature pre-colonial food, right? And they kind of stalked your Instagram. They look really fancy. Who are you cooking for, and how much does it cost to eat these dinners?
This is a conversation, and it's actually something that we have been confronted with.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to doing these type of dinners, in that the demographic that I come from on a reservation can't afford $150 to come sit down and eat a course out meal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the pictures that you see. But in getting confronted with those issues, we don't really put forward that, say, like the event that we had this last fall over Thanksgiving week in Manhattan and Brooklyn, that we start those things off with community service work. That out of our own pockets, we fed the indigenous community at the American Indian House in New York. We're feeding both aspects, and we're using the aspect of those fancy pop-up dinners to fund our work within the community. And so it's really just a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen, I think I talked about this last week too, but Ugly Delicious on Netflix. He talked with the chef from Noma in Copenhagen and how they did a pop-up in Tulum. And we're like, oh, we're going to feature the local ladies' tortillas and all that. But it felt so wrong and it looked so wrong. And I wonder if you felt similarly as the one cooking.
I have not seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, what struck you wrong about it?
I don't know how much it costs, but I'm guessing upwards of $100 for a coursed out meal. And it'd be like a single charred Brussels sprout leaf over this local wood. And none of the dinner guests were from Tulum. They were all, I don't know, people from Copenhagen, people from America who had traveled, maybe saw it on social media, went to Tulum. And it was kind of like an experience, right, of this local environment. And sure, to some degree, it is educational and does open people's eyes to what's going on there, like another aspect of culture. But still, it just felt dirty, felt wrong.
Right. So Neftali, we have conversated about this before when it comes to Red Zepi and Noma and things like that, where when they were in Mexico, we're like, well, what are they doing for the community?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and who had access to that food and who gained any knowledge from that and who was taken from, you know, I mean, these are all things that we have to take into consideration. And you want to speak, that's a little more in Neftali's turf, being from Oaxaca, so do you want to talk on that, Neft?
Yes, absolutely. We definitely had a conversation online last year about cultural appropriation with a lot of people. A lot of people actually engaged, some in good terms, some in not so good terms. As Carlos said, I'm from Oaxaca, and I've always been very outspoken on cultural appropriation, culinary appropriation of Mexican food, specifically from indigenous communities in Oaxaca. I knowing that restaurant was going on, that a pop-up restaurant was going on in Tulum, definitely rubs me the wrong way when Mexico has one of the largest indigenous populations. The Yucatan Peninsula has a lot of Mayan people. They have, not only they don't have access to their land or to their ocean, but nonetheless, they don't have access to any of these luxuries. There are a lot of people from outside and come and utilize. So I think that when it comes to values, not only the collective but myself, I need to call it what it is, and it's just another at the continuation of colonialism, using indigenous cuisine to highlight and make money. Mm-hmm. And serve people that can pay, you know, what was it, like $500 to go have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I also think when it comes to values for the collective, this is some of the conversations we've been having. There is no food sovereignty without actually addressing food access. And as Carlos was saying, we're trying to walk a fine line between doing some fancy dinners, but more importantly, providing food and being part of the communities that we go into or that we belong to.
Mm-hmm. Could you define what food sovereignty, or more specifically, indigenous food sovereignty is, and tribal food insecurity versus security?
Yeah, I mean, you have to go right to the heart of it with that conversation and look at what just happened in South Africa. You know, I mean, what is decolonization? It's about land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an interesting conversation. You know, you get into indigenous food sovereignty, you have to talk about how many layers and how many centuries of warfare have been, you know, held against our food systems and our people. Mm-hmm. And the fact that any of our food waste still exists is a testament to the resilience of indigenous people here. So food sovereignty in the broad scale is, I guess, going to have to be a reflection of work that we're doing at home, right? The work that we're trying to do with recreating our traditional food systems to provide for our people. And I'm hoping that, I mean, you know, just like most educated people do, that our food system is broken in America. Mm-hmm. And without an absolute change, and, you know, we're not, it's just not gonna work, you know. I remember what article it was that came out last month that I had shared with some friends and with the collective about, you know, that 30% of farmers in the world feed 70% of the population, mm-hmm. where 70% of the farmable land base is held by major corporations, mm-hmm. who use the majority of the water, the majority of the chemicals, the majority of things, but they're only feeding 30% of the population, mm-hmm. you know, and like that is broken. I mean, so when you talk about food sovereignty, it's about, you know, what we're trying to do in our communities, to make ourselves self-sustaining and do it in our traditional ways, and hoping that, you know, the visual and the action and the things that we're doing in those systems bleed into the broader scale. And so,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not only this very small percentage of people feeding a very large percentage of people, but also there's so much food waste, you know, in grocery stores or restaurants, so much food is going wasted while so many people are still going hungry. And this is a big question of, not one that I expect you to know the answer to, but how do you think we can go from just saying the system's broken to actually making steps to unbreak it?
I can speak to that. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you know, I really like the food sovereignty definition by Welfare Culture that goes along these lines, the right of indigenous nations to define their own diets and shape food systems that are congruent with their spiritual and cultural values. Mm-hmm. And what that really translates for me is that every tribal community, everyone should have access to culturally appropriate food that is healthy and that is relevant to their culture and their traditional diet. Mm-hmm. When it comes to talking about what are we doing to change the system, many of the members, all of the members of the collective are doing work in their communities. As well, we also belong to different organizations that push for a better food system for everyone. I am heading to D.C. next week to advocate for a better farm bill for everyone, not only for indigenous communities, but for everyone. I think the Farm Bill is one of the pieces of legislation that touches everyone, and whether you like it or not, and there's a lot of programs that are in danger under this administration of being cut. Things like SNAP, WIC, emergency food, school food, and those are. And I think that we, as engaged citizens, have a responsibility to push back and advocate a better food system at all levels. Mm-hmm. Not only growing your own food, not only at the grassroots levels in your community, but also we need to push at the national level, at the state level, for better policies for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually read, a friend sent me this New York Times article that showed that these great, quote-unquote, policies are put into place, but then there's still so many restrictions on what these mothers, these lesser fortunate people can buy with their benefits. And so it's like a catch-22 almost.
Well, I think that we have to recognize and be realistic that a lot of the programs that are in place to feed people that fall under the farm bill, under the nutrition chapter, were compromises for the New Deal. So it's not that the government really wanted to do this for the people. Those are political compromises that were put in place to pass other bills. Mm-hmm.
This is Meant to be Eaten. We're talking about broken food systems, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group, or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
We're back. This is Meant to be Eaten. I'm your host, Coral Lee, and I'm speaking with two chefs from the iCollective. We were just talking about broken food systems kind of globally, and I wanted to ask you two, what does decolonizing a food system really look like?
Well, I mean, for myself, it's Carlos. I want to kind of tie that in with a question that you and I had spoken about.
Please.
What is an indigenous foods activist?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a terminology that, as for myself, I dropped the term chef.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did that is because it's a Eurocentric mind frame.
Mm-hmm.
In the entirety of the kitchen environment, right? It's about being the head of the organization and ruling and dictating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very toxic environment, as you can see by what's happening in the restaurant world right now and the shakeups that are going on. Controlling all of the produce and all these things, whereas the work that I do is the exact opposite of that. I'm not in the kitchen anymore, for one.
Hmm.
Very rarely am I. But when I'm out harvesting and I'm out doing these things, or when I'm growing foods or any of these things, the environment is my teacher. The environment is my kitchen. My environment is dictates to me. I don't get to dictate to it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not a chef. I'm an indigenous foods activist. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about decolonizing systems, you have to start with self, right? You have to shed those things. Because I can't move forward in my work if I'm holding on to the ideals of what has suppressed me for all this time. Mm-hmm. So to decolonize the food system, what do we have to do? Right, we have to quit looking at it as we hold dominion over things, right? Mm-hmm. You have like that Christian ideal, that manifest destiny ideal that says to you that, oh, we have to hold dominion and we are the controllers of everything. And it's the exact opposite of indigenous thought process, right? I just was reading Gregory Cahete's Native Science book, and he's describing something that I've never really been able to put into words, but it's just real simple between the spatial and linear thought processes that differentiate an indigenous mind and Western mind. That to get from point A to point B in the linear Western mind frame is to do it as quickly and most efficiently as possible. Mm-hmm. Whereas for us, to get from A to B is possible, but it's not necessarily going to happen. But it could after I go doing all these other things. And then I might look back and not even get there and think, oh, why did I ever want to do that? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we just have such different ideals. Mm-hmm. And so we know that nothing is ever stationary, right? Some things are only true while they are. And so to decolonize a food system, you have to really look into that concept and know, like, we're not the boss. Like, you, by thinking that we're the boss of what's going on, we have a whole nation of GMOs and chemicals that have to be put on them so they can even activate to grow, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. So we need to drop those illusions and hold our food system and our food providers accountable. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think that's really interesting that I kind of posited at the beginning of the episode, why aren't we seeing a ton of, you know, indigenous fancy or hip restaurants around, and it could just be a different value system?
Right. You want to touch on that, Neff?
I think that there's the value system in which something that Carlos mentioned resonates with me, of actually being of service to the community. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, we need to, as cooks, as community members, we need to make sure that our peoples have access to food first, and that we are being of service to the community before we take worry about sharing with everyone else. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's one part, but the other part is also access to economic justice. If we don't have access to land, which is the basis of wealth in this country, we really are not in a position in which we can in which we have a mass capital to open restaurants. So I think that there's plenty of indigenous people working in the system. The fact is there's no indigenous cooks or indigenous chefs running their own restaurant. It's really a question of economic justice, mm-hmm. not a question of whether people would love the opportunity to give it a try or not. Mm-hmm.
So then what do you kind of make of this trendy thing to now be an urban forager or to cook farm to table, which seems to be really hip? Like, I saw this ad for this really fancy mushroom knife, which does look so excessive and not at all. It kind of like completely misses the point. How do you feel about all this?
Oh, you know, I mean, that's what I do, mm-hmm. you know, for a living, is hang out in the woods and collect foods and I have only recently come to really contemplate it. I was sitting at my grandmother's house probably about 3 weeks ago, and we were discussing about what I do, and they're talking to me about how did I end up there. And I said, well, you know, like my food memories. Like my grandmother giving us a bag and telling us to go collect purslane, or harvesting out of the garden, or being up in the mountains foraging with my grandfather, and these things. And I said, you know, I never realized that other people didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't until I was in the food industry that I realized that that wasn't a thing. And so what my aunt said to me was, well, I guess we take these things for granted. And that made me contemplate, is it a trend right now? Are people stopping to take things for granted? Like, are people finally starting to come back to the realization that we were provided for before modern agricultural practices, you know, or... I mean, of course, there's always people profiteering, and, you know, I mean, we're in the uber neoliberal state of the world right now, and I mean, there's always going to be people that come at it from that perspective. But you know, from my own self, I look at it like, oh, well, it's about time. Now let's make sure that we keep it sustainable.
Yeah, Dan Barber came out with this new line of seeds, and when it was announced on the internet, they looked like an Apple product, and the way that people were holding these seeds and just like just all the fame around it, it felt like another electronic or like another commodity. And how do you use this kind of newfound awareness to your advantage as an educator? Are you like, finally, yes, welcome, let's learn about this, or is it off-putting?
I mean, anything from the commodification standpoint, like when we're just trying to create food bases and food systems to feed our people, right? Like, all this other stuff, like being here with you today and doing pop-up dinners in major cities and being in this magazine and that magazine and this video, and, you know, those are kind of all obsolete. When it comes down to it, you know, and so the commodification aspect, it's almost peripheral to me, because we don't engage in it. And so, I mean, I don't sit in front of television. I don't, you know, I mean, I don't, those aren't things I do. So I have to, I guess, just look at it from my own individual perspective and in how I live and how I walk daily, and know that I don't partake in that, and that the systems that we're trying to create within our communities and as the iCollective base, that we don't commodify ourselves and that we don't sell ourselves in that manner. So I don't know who else to answer that one.
Well, your experience going out to gather your food is kind of a special and a unique one. You know, there are a lot of indigenous people that have to rely on foods distributed from government programs, and you know, and it's like, I've read a lot of Sherman Alexie's books, and like, that's what I have come to associate with indigenous or Indian quote unquote food. And so can you talk about this like complicated relationship with fry bread?
I'm gonna let you start that one off, Neff.
Well, I was hoping that you would take that one on, but
I will.
See, my position on comfort food, which is really what what fried bread is. It's fried bread is comfort food. And comfort food, whether it's good for us or not, has shaped our food memories and our visceral memories based on what we had access to throughout generations. If I had access, if I grew up in Oaxaca in with my grandma, and if I had access to tortillas fried in lard, if I had access to whatever food we had access to based on our economic circumstances, that's food that I'm gonna gravitate to, towards, because that's those are the foods that created my memory. Mm-hmm. So my position on fried bread or no fried bread, greasy foods or not greasy foods, has evolved throughout the years towards a more self-compassionate understanding of food and memories and visceralities, in the sense that who am I to judge who eats what when our peoples don't have access to good food?
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, I have to be very careful on how I have an opinion about food when it comes to food that is pushed down proactively in our communities. Let's say soda or other foods are not very healthy. I have a responsibility to
Oh no, I think he cut out. Okay. Carlos, do you want to add to this?
Yeah. And it's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, he was getting to the meat of it. I was so excited.
Say for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I might eat it a few times a year. And I don't make it, and I won't provide it to people because I feel like it's my responsibility not to contribute to bad health within my community. But as Naftali was saying, and things that we have to be really careful about, food shaming, you know, and how that affects people that don't have access to or the knowledge of ways to provide for themselves. A little historical background of breads in the Americas, in the Southwest. I mean, fried bread is generally associated with the Navajo Nation. And I do a lot of food studies, and I have ethnobotanical studies from the early 1800s and congressional papers about food and, all these things. And I've come across numerous times the precursor to the modern fry bread. And that is with, nut flours like acorns and sunflower seeds and things like that, even mesquite, things like colt's foot, which is an herb that kind of grows on the banks of ditches and things, and burned down into an ash and used as a leavener. And then whole berries and things like this formed into a bread substance. And in some instances, cooked straight into the coals. In other instances, cooked in fat. Right? So it wasn't like there wasn't something similar to it previously.
Mm-hmm.
And in discussions that we have quite often, because fried bread is a constant topic, this would have been a good one for Brian Yazzie to be on here for. he's always in this conversation. Is that unless we as indigenous cooks and chefs and activists and things are not providing an option that's better and available, we can't judge it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Those are the things that we're currently working on as our events and as we're cooking for our people, is to provide alternative opera, you know, and alternative thoughts and alternative tastes that are accessible. So that's how I deal with the fry bread issue.
I think Neftali's back. Did you want to add something to what you were saying about memory and kind of this tiptoe dance around food shaming?
Yeah, I think Carlos covered some of the rest, but I guess the last thing that I would like to say is that we have the responsibility of self-passion, not only towards ourselves, but towards the community. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we also have the responsibility to speak up against corporations and against basically against a system that has taken advantage of the people's needs. Mm-hmm.
This is Meant to be Eaten. I've been speaking with two Indigenous food activists from iCollective. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.